today we're welcoming Kurt Schaefer, as I mentioned. Kurt obtained his BA degree summa cum laude from Bradley University in 1980. He obtained both the MA degree and the PhD degree from the University of Michigan in economics in 1982 and 1984, respectively. He then spent 2 years as an assistant prof of economics in Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. And then in 1987, he joined the faculty at Calvin College, where he's been ever since. And he's now a professor of economics. He's published quite widely, and this year, as I mentioned, he is the Calvin College lecturer and is traveling hither and yon giving lectures. So, Kurt, we're very happy to have you here today. The topic of Dr. Schaefer's lecture is Reengineering Poverty Policy in the United States.
Kurt? Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much for coming over. It's really a great pleasure to be here with you. We'll turn on the romantic lighting now. Such a terrific place to be in Vancouver, my first time out here. And
oh, that's great. Thank you.
And I have so much respect for what you're doing here and what you're doing as a group in this forum. So thank you very much for having me. And these are the best seminar cookies I've ever had. They're really fine. So for me, that's a special treat. I think you might say that the great economic question of the 1980s was whether planned socialism was viable in the long run, and how many of us would end up living under planned socialism. And the answer pretty much came in by 1989 that it wasn't very viable, which left us with a new question for the 1990s. What kind of capitalism are we going to have? What sort of capitalism will we be living with? What kind do we even want? Today's lecture is an attempt to lay out in brief form what we've learned during the 1990s from experiments with the social welfare system in the United States. That is, in what ways can capitalism be improved by changing public policy and personal virtue? I'll briefly say, and I could say a lot more about this, but I'd like to make common cause early on and say the United States and Canada really have a great deal in common on this issue. And as economists look at the world, you could think of in 1990 sort of three basic models of capitalism: the European model, the German social market economy, a large role for the state in social insurance and welfare and worker safeties and the market allocation of resources. A Japanese model, much smaller role for the state in providing social services, but a much larger role for the state in allocating resources. And then the North American model, the Northern North American model, the Canadian United States model. Both countries have similar distributions of income. They have a similar threshold for what I understand you call low income, what we call poverty, a poverty line in the United States. We have a similar proportion of the population in poverty in both countries. We've gone over time through the same spells, increasing inequality in the 70s and 80s. From the mid-80s to the 90s, both countries kind of recovering middle-class jobs. Very similar levels of inequality in the two countries. The United States having a little more redistributive system in the 70s and 80s, Canadians a little more redistributive in the 90s, but really very similar to each other. And a similar experience in welfare reform. In the United States, as we started experimenting with state-level devolution of the system, waivers to states, Canada started devolving to the provinces, especially British Columbia and New Brunswick. In the early 90s, a self-sufficiency project, SSP. In 1996, the United States rewrote its basic welfare legislation. The same year, the federal Canadian government devolved more of welfare policy to the provinces. So we have a lot in common to talk about together. What I'd like to do is to try to summarize quickly, loosely, the last 40 years of experience in the United States. Because I think if you just look at 1996 legislation as the welfare reform, you might come to some wrong conclusions. So I'll try to give kind of a big picture of what's been going on in the United States, mainly, in poverty policy the last 40 years. Then I'll try to talk a little about what's changed in the last 10 years and how it was changed. And then I'll try to talk a little about evaluating those changes, the apparent results of welfare reform in the United States. I probably don't have to motivate this much, but briefly let me mention why I think this is really a worthy topic for us to think about. First of all, what we can learn about practical care of our neighbors. Christians believe from Scripture we're responsible to care for our neighbor. But in God's providence, we don't have a lot of detailed information about just how that would be done in a modern post-industrial economy. And so it's mainly a matter of natural revelation, I think, of coming with a set of norms and trying to discern what seems to work well and what seems to be counterproductive. So that's one reason. Second, it's a policy area in which ultimate questions are always just under the surface, even at a fairly technical discussion with a lot of statistics. You're always just a hair's breadth away from thinking about what is human nature, what is the nature of persons, what's the nature of a good society, how are we to be related to each other. And third, at least in the case of the United States, explicitly religious organizations and traditions have had fairly substantial influence on the way policy has changed in the last decade. And so just for models of Christian citizenship, good or bad, Christians might be interested in looking at the last decade in the United States. Now, a disclaimer or two. I think we've only got an hour, and I'll really, really try not to talk too fast, but I just really enjoy this topic, and I've got a lot I can talk about, so I'll try to not overwhelm or speak too quickly, but you discipline me if I'm going too quickly, if I say something that doesn't make sense or some kind of statistic that you're just not familiar with, please just stop us there and we'll try and work it out on the spot. All right. First, I think to try and set a little context, that might be good. That is, before we talk about poverty policy, we got to think about the thing that the policy is trying to affect, the basic distribution of income in the United States. Don't look at that. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. And the level of income in the two places. So we come to the audience participation part of our lecture. Just take a little quiz with me. If I asked you in the mid-90s there, where dramatic changes are starting to happen, you look kind of the baseline before these changes. Just jot down if you have a pen. What do you think the typical income in the United States was? Median income. Half people wealthier, half people poor. And think of it per household. So a little bit more than if you thought per person. So what's a typical, I'll say American income just because it's clumsy to keep saying United States citizens' income, but you know, I realize United States citizens are not the only North Americans, but I'll just telescope it down. Wealthiest country in the world, really. What do you think the threshold would be to be wealthy in the United States? Say top 20%. What would your family income have to be to put you in the top 20%? In 1995, it would be not much different by now.
U.S. dollars.
How about super wealthy, to be in the top 5% in the United States? What do you think the income threshold would be to get there? Don't say it out loud. Spoil the quiz. Top 5%. How about relatively poor? Where the bottom 20%, where's the threshold, do you think? The bottom quintile. And how about quite poor, the bottom 10% of the United States distribution of income? Do you have some just figures in your mind? All right, median income, 1995, $34,000. That's per household, not per person. Per person would be down in the low 20s. To be wealthy, top 20%, $60,000. To be quite wealthy, top 5%, $110,000. Two university faculty salaries, you're in the top 5% or better in the United States. To be in the bottom 20%, around $15,000. Which at that time was a little above what we call the poverty level, what I think Canadians call low income threshold. To be, you know, quite relatively poor, bottom 10%, around $9,000 a year in 1995. I think most people who take that little quiz are surprised by how low the numbers are. You think super wealthy, it's got to be millions, you know. Average income in America, most people would say it's got to be $60,000, $70,000. So there it is. Here's another way to think about income distribution, and this will give you a little more feeling Canada relative to the United States. Now, these are per capita figures, so they're different numbers, and there's a whole reason why I did that. Another thing I did in this slide was to use so-called purchasing power parity numbers. You know, I don't have to tell Canadians that when you translate values across an exchange rate, how things can get kind of confused, because exchange rates are... Yeah, sorry, I had to bring it up. But anyway, this avoids that problem. So it tries to measure real purchasing power of the incomes across the border, you know, and what they can purchase in their own currency without the artificial effect of an exchange rate. And, you know, the basic story, it would, by the way, not be wise to get too consumed about particular numbers in this chart because charts can lie, and I've done the very best I could, but, you know, don't get too hung up on specifics. And I mean, 54% of all statistics are made up on the spot. Anyway, so, but the point here is the distribution is similar in the two countries. In Canada, there's a little less inequality, as usually measured, and that's mainly because Canada kind of snips off the tops of the upper income levels. So the actual level of income of the poorest is really very similar across the borders. But there's more measured inequality in the United States because kind of the upward possibility is a little more open-ended in the United States. Yeah. And these are, by the way, before tax income, so it's not just the effect of Canadian tax rates that does this. It's just a kind of a leveling off at upper income possibilities. So the poor in the two countries, kind of an absolute standard of living, are in about the same boat across the two borders. Now, just to get us all on the same page, and I will try to not belabor this, but I thought I should just talk through the main programs in the United States that redistribute income, just so we kind of all have as background names of programs in our minds. So here's just a slide that'll give you kind of a pie chart of American social welfare spending and what the different programs are, their names, their relative sizes. You know, by far the largest programs are aimed at elderly people and disabled people by virtue of being elderly or disabled. The Social Security program, about half of all welfare spending, what we call welfare spending in the United States. I know a lot of people think of it as just a savings program, and aren't we getting back what we paid into it, and how can that be welfare? But there's actually quite a large redistributive element in Social Security that I can't get into because of time. Benefits go to old age benefits, survivors' benefits, and disabled persons. I think that's probably enough said. There could be more said. The Medicare program also targeted at disabled and elderly people. It's a public health insurance program. You know, the state does not own the health care system, but it does subsidize the health insurance system to grant access to folks. Post Social Security program is about $400 billion. The Medicare program is about half that, about $200 billion a year. Medicare serves around 20 million, sorry, I said there are around 40 million people, 38 million people. So just a rough idea of how big they are. Let's go next to the Medicaid program, similar to Medicare, but now focused not at age and disability, but at income level. So it's state-subsidized health insurance for the poor because they're poor. About the same size, $200 billion a year, about the same number of people as Medicare, about 20 million, 40 million folks, sorry. If you're wondering about the uninsured in the United States, about as many people as in Medicare or Medicaid are uninsured, so around 38 million people. Most of those would, if you kind of took a standard that you'd accept for other goods, about what would make the good affordable or unaffordable, you know, like a percentage of income spent on a good, and applied that to health insurance, we've got maybe 38 million uninsured, don't participate in these programs, don't receive insurance to their workplace. Probably half of those would pass an affordability test. Depending on how you define affordability, maybe as many as three quarters are. It's affordable, but they don't choose to insure themselves. Maybe as few as one quarter, somewhere around there. So we've got, you know, roughly 20 million people uninsured and not able to afford health insurance. And that's sort of our remaining dangling issue that I won't talk about today, health care. Should we just kind of gradually expand coverage through Medicaid to insure those folks who are left, or should we have a dramatic change in policy to insure them? Other programs, then, relatively small-looking programs, you know, the things we more traditionally think of as welfare, as income support. And let me briefly talk through what those programs are. First, we have a host of housing programs. It's only about $30 billion. Well, only $30 billion is more than my retirement account, but it's not relatively a big part of government spending. You know, loosely, we got a lot of different programs, public housing, rent subsidies, all sorts of things. In general, we try to keep rents below about a third of a person's income by some kind of housing support. Only about 5 million people involved in that kind of housing's relatively cheap in the United States. We have SSI, Supplemental Security Income. That is a program that's meant to supplement Social Security, as the name sort of implies. So a person might have had such low earnings while they were working that when they retire, there's not much Social Security benefit there for them. Or they might be disabled and not qualify for the Social Security benefit because they didn't work enough years. And SSI tries to plug that gap for disabled and retired. AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children. That is the traditional income support program, the program that pays cash benefits to folks, almost entirely limited to families in which there's just one parent, and the vast, vast majority of those would be women, unmarried women with children. That program ended in effectively in the spring of 1997, the legislation's in 1996. When people think of welfare reform in America, they're usually thinking the end of AFDC, which was replaced by TANF, T-A-N-F, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. So AFDC became TANF. And the name of the law that changed AFDC into TANF is PRWORA, Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. So PRWORA changed AFDC to TANF. Eventually, we will get to, in seven flavors, what happened when PRWORA came into being, the ways in which the support system changed. Good question. So AFDC, again, around $20 billion a year. It's really a fairly small program. The EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, different kind of income support program. One in which now the benefit goes only to people who are working. So if you work no hours, you receive no benefit. In effect, it's a wage subsidy. It allows people to receive more income than the wage paid by the employer, and it comes as a federal tax credit. You fill out your federal tax form. You earned a certain income. You have a certain number of children. Based on that income and number of children, you can receive a credit. It's a refundable credit, so even if you owe no taxes, you can receive a check. It can be set up more recently so that you receive it periodically, so it's not just a once-a-year benefit like that. Here's a little slide that will give us some feeling for how the EITC works, and it turns out it's a fairly important component of this welfare reform process. On the horizontal axis, you have the earnings of a family that they would declare on their tax form in April, and on the vertical axis, you have the amount of credit that a family would receive. So the basic idea is if you're a very low income and you go out and start working, the federal government will subsidize that wage, depending on how big your family is, to the tune of about 40 cents on the dollar. So you get a minimum wage job at $5.50 an hour, and your effective wage is going to be up over $8. You receive this earned income tax credit. It only goes to people who are working, so there's some incentive to get out of non-work into work. That happens until you get up to, still below the poverty level. So you get a subsidy. Then you coast for a while. You can earn more money, and your credit doesn't shrink, so there's no disincentive to work. And in general, the concept was, by the mid-90s, by trying to combine, AFDC support and the EITC and a housing subsidy and food stamps and Medicaid, we're going to get any family with one person working 40 hours a week at minimum wage up above the poverty line. Turned out it didn't quite work that way in the mid-90s, but that was the attempt, late 80s, early 90s. And then after, a certain level of income, you got to start phasing it out, or people like me would be claiming an earned income tax credit. So eventually there's an effective tax rate that as you earn more income, you lose your credit. So there's really a negative subsidy on your wage, there's a tax rate. And that tax rate is you're roughly upper teens percentage. Most middle-income Americans are paying about a 15% marginal federal tax rate. So these folks have a slightly higher marginal tax rate, but not a lot higher. And, it's just one of the tensions of policy to have a big enough subsidy at low income to matter and to not have too much of a disincentive to work, to not have too steep a tax rate from there on. The support continues out to fairly high wages. So these folks are almost median income earners and still able to claim some tax credit, but that's just... those are the tensions you get into for such a program. So that's how the EITC works, the Earned Income Tax Credit. I didn't mention a couple of these programs. Unemployment compensation is not a big issue for our purposes. But in the United States, it's a state-run program, like AFDC was, which is to say every state decides how big the benefit will be. In AFDC, the federal government then chipped in roughly a matching grant. So if a state says, we're going to give people $200 a month, qualify, the federal government says, okay, roughly we'll chip in another $200 a month, they get $400 a month. And that was a pretty typical benefit in the 70s, 80s, 90s, about $400 per person per month. But states can vote different levels. So in the United States, the lowest
AFDC benefits were under $300 a month. The highest were up around $1,000 a month. Quite a spread. Likewise with unemployment insurance. It's a state-run program that's matched by the federal government. Briefly, just so you know how it works, you have to be unemployed against your will, so involuntarily dismissed. You have to be seeking employment, or at least able to convince your caseworker that you're seeking employment. Then you receive a benefit, kind of on average about a year and a half long benefit. It would reimburse you for about a third of your prior wages. There's no limit on income or assets for that program, so you know the relatively higher wage people get more benefit from that program. Whereas with AFDC, there were stringent limits on income and assets. For example, if your car is worth more than $1,500, no AFDC. So there's really an incentive for people to spend down as they get into poverty till they're kind of hopeless, and then they can qualify, but then the benefits are so small it's a little hard to dig back up. Then there are food stamps. You know, in the United States, you can buy either stamps or debit cards. They're only, in principle, usable for buying food. You buy those cards at a discount, and the discount depends on how big your family is and what your income is. So it's a way of an in-kind transfer program, trying to directly give folks food in kind of a flexible way. All right, well, there are the big eight welfare programs in the United States over the last 40 years. Now, a little history. That was all background, I'm afraid. So here we go. The last 40 years, you could roughly divide poverty policy into four epochs. The first one running from roughly mid-60s to mid-70s. A revolution in the role of the state in maintaining some kind of social insurances for people. So starting in 1964, there's the Civil Rights Act in the United States that tries to do something about our apartheid system that had hung on for so long. In 1965, Lyndon Johnson's administration creates or dramatically expands a number of these social programs we've just talked about, the Great Society programs. Richard Nixon, starting in 1968, embraces those programs, expands them, expands it into workplace regulation, environmental regulation. So roughly those 10 years, Johnson, Nixon years, dramatic increase in the size and funding and number of federal programs. Well, you know, it's a phrase that Kennedy used, and if I had a lot more time, we could talk. In a way, welfare reform began in 1961 with Kennedy. But what most people think of as the war on poverty was Johnson's sort of proclamation, 1965. That's where Medicaid came from, and food stamps was just a little commodity distribution program, and dramatic expansion in funding. So that's sort of the first epoch. Then from roughly mid-70s to kind of 88, 87, around in there, you have this level funding. And now the number here is real per-person expenditures on the 80 largest redistribution programs in the United States added together. So it's per-recipient spending, and it's real spending in the sense that we've already accounted for changes in inflation. So you don't have to think, oh, it's just lower in the 60s because everything was cheaper. I've accounted for that. So the real after-inflation benefits dramatically rose through the mid-70s, then leveled off. States basically did not fund AFDC in such a way as to keep up with inflation. You know? So the AFDC benefits kept rising, but inflation rose more quickly, and state legislatures just didn't choose to keep up. Now, on the other hand, the funding stayed level because the number of people qualifying started to rise so dramatically. So in the 50s, the majority of people in AFDC are widows. In the late 60s, early 70s, the majority of people receiving AFDC are divorced women. By the late 70s, mid-80s, the majority of women are never married, single mothers. So these basic changes in the social structure of the United States kept the amount funded in those programs about the same. Even though the federal government, you may know, in 1981 especially, with a great deal of effort to restrain eligibility, to set higher standards for eligibility, and yet the number of people eligible kept growing, and so spending was fairly level. They're the first two epochs. By the mid-80s, there is, according to most accounts anyway, there's some cause for concern. Let me give you a few statistics to think about. In the previous 20 years, the caseload in AFDC, the number of people qualifying for income support, had increased by 270%. Food stamps had twice as many recipients as AFDC, much more dramatic expansion.
Medicaid, more participants than food stamps. So these programs were kind of hemorrhaging in numbers of people qualifying. Real spending on these programs had increased by about 230%. That's after inflation, just over a tripling in spending. The percentage of participants who were working, in the 60s it had been around 15%. By the mid-80s it's down around 5%, about a third. So increasingly this kind of separation from the labor market and the kind of hope for eventual prosperity that comes from being connected to the labor market. Average income of participants had fallen by about a third. The proportion of single women on welfare who were never married had quadrupled in 16 years. So concerns about family structure, all kinds of things that may have been due to changes in welfare policy. Now you might say, those are not good things, but maybe they're offset by improvements in poverty. You know, maybe we kind of buy better income levels by giving up some family structure, some other things. And unfortunately, the balance of evidence seems to be that the traditional welfare programs just were not doing much about poverty during this period. Now, there is a significant reduction in poverty rates in the 60s, which some people will point to and say, well, there, you know, the programs did bring down poverty. Unfortunately, really more than half of that change happened before the Great Society programs began in the mid-60s. It seems to be the result of economic growth, the boom under the Kennedy years. That boom continues to 1970, so it's not difficult to draw the conclusion the improvements in the 60s were due to basic economic growth, you know, rising tide lifting all ships. The concern is that after 1970, poverty rates just sit there. Through prosperity, through recessions, they just the whole idea of poverty seems to come unhitched from general prosperity, which is to say people who are poor seem to no longer participate in the general benefits of a healthy economy. So just poverty rates are just in the low teens from then on, in prosperity and bad times. African-American poverty rates just hover low to mid-30%, about a third of all African-American families in poverty. Good times, bad times, it's just kind of come unhitched after 1970 or so. So the goal of the programs was to reduce poverty. Many people by the mid-80s are drawing the conclusion there must be a better way than what we've constructed so far. That would bring us to Epoch 3, from about 1988 till the mid-90s, where there's actually a pretty dramatic escalation in spending. This is per person adjusted for inflation spending, with the George Bush Sr. and early Clinton administrations. There's an attempt to really pretty generously expand income redistribution programs while changing them somewhat to try to create some incentives toward work and toward eventually digging out of poverty. So general attempt to expand the program, be more generous, but try to alter some things. For example, the earned income tax credit dramatically expanded twice in that period, thinking we'll try to create some incentive to gradually work out of non-work into some employment, and after some time in employment, your skills improve, you gradually dig out. So a number of things like that. Medicaid was roughly doubled. Coverage was removed from being attached to AFDC so that you go out and get a job, you don't lose your medical benefits automatically. Things like that. Attempts to change the incentive structure. Unfortunately, in that period, benefits rise by about as much as they did in the 60s and 70s, but all in just 5 years. So a pretty rapid ramping up of benefits. Participation in AFDC rose by 40% in that period. So by the mid-90s, most people are thinking, time for something new. You know, these attempts we've made so far at trying to adjust the system don't seem to be doing what we had in mind. Here's an example of something people are concerned about by the mid-90s. These are just some demographic numbers. Birth rate for all unmarried women. There you see, general marriage rates drifting downward, divorce rates drifting downward, but these family structure problems just seeming to hang on. At the same time, late 80s, early 90s, one thing that we did try in this burst of spending that yielded some very useful information was the idea of state-level waivers. That is, we had federal policy, federal law about AFDC program, other income support programs, but individual states could apply for a waiver, permission to restructure their own state-level program differently from the federal structure of things. Future President Bill Clinton, governor of Arkansas, was one of the great pushers for this possibility. Let us just experiment a little and try to figure out what might be
going wrong in the general federal policy. So starting late 80s, early 90s, there's a series of these waiver experiments. And when the federal government granted a waiver to a state, they required that the state fund a serious evaluation of that waiver. So they wanted to gain some information about the waiver. Really two kinds of things were going on in almost all those waivers. And here's a little slide to help us have a look at them. Mandatory employment programs and then employment requirements with earning subsidies. That is, some states did what was mentioned before, workfare or welfare to work policies, in which as a condition of receiving support, you must be either engaged in direct job training or actually out working. It's just a requirement of support. And some states did that alone. Other states did that in combination with some kind of wage subsidy, kind of like a state-level additional earned income tax credit. British Columbia and New Brunswick were an example of that self-sufficiency project, an example in which they actually created at least four different categories of person and then randomly assigned people to those categories. Some people stay on the traditional program. Some people get into a workfare program. Other people get into workfare with a wage subsidy. Other people just get the wage subsidy and not the work requirement. And then by comparing across groups, kind of a social experiment, which of these policies seems to do what? To poverty. In the states that just had the mandatory employment, no kind of wage subsidy, here are some of the implications of those experiments, these first couple bullets here. And they were surprising to, I think, everybody at the time. First, the benefits, you know, the increased income from having a work requirement, it was spread pretty evenly across skill levels and education levels. There was fear that the least job-ready people, you know, you say, well, you got to work or you get no benefits. And they say, what have I got to offer in a labor market? And that those people just get sort of trounced. And in the eating of the pudding, that didn't turn out that way. The benefit pretty evenly spread, which is to say it looks like for most people in these programs, there are pretty significant benefits to experience, to job experience, relative to training and education and other kinds of abstract and long-term education, at least initially. And then maybe after 3-4 years in the job market, then it's time to think about an associate's degree or something or GED. But it looks like the initial move out of poverty is helped by experience more than by abstractions. Second little bullet, work first programs turned out to be more effective than more expensive training and education programs, just moving people into jobs. But the last bullet, by themselves, little effect on poverty or income. That is, in most of these states that try workfare programs, people do move into jobs, they get jobs, their earnings rise, but pretty much dollar for dollar they lose income assistance. So not much effect on poverty rates, poverty levels, family income. On the other hand, states that tried earnings supplements with job requirements, much better outcomes. And that affects increase in employment, as you might expect, but also falling poverty rates, increasing incomes in families. Interestingly, not much change in the state budgets. That is, states don't save a lot of money by subsidizing wages and requiring work, at least not initially. But it looks like it's a much more hopeful strategy for moving people gradually out of poverty into independence. For example, these programs like the New Brunswick British Columbian SSP program, a high ratio, if you kind of try to compute the amount of dollars generated in families to get them out of poverty, divided by the number of dollars spent on the program, bang for the buck ratio. New Brunswick, Minnesota, British Columbia, the ratio is about 2.5 to 1. So kind of for every dollar the state puts into a program, $2.5 worth of income generated in poor families. If you look at other programs that nominally look cheaper because you're not subsidizing wages, the ratio bang per buck comes in somewhere between 50 cents and negative 50 cents. So for every dollar the state spends on just requiring people to go out and get a job, they generate 50 cents of income at best among poor families. Sometimes families actually lose 50 cents on the dollar for the state the state's paying, you know. I mean, the state would be much better just handing them the buck, you know what I mean? Save half the inefficiency of it or more. So that was an interesting, valuable set of lessons out of these state waiver programs. I think in the interest of time, we have other interesting things we could talk about, but I'm just going to move on to the fourth era in our little picture here, what most of us think of as welfare reform, from the mid-90s onward. So what changed in the 90s, and what were the effects of those changes? You can see that something that didn't change is total levels of spending on income redistribution programs. So in sum, spending on income maintenance stays unchanged. but there's quite a reallocation of the spending. And I just want to walk through that in bit by bit. So here's slide number one out of three slides, PERWORA and welfare reform. First, a set of sort of in-the-background changes. These were changes that might not be thought of as official welfare reform, you know, changes in the structure of programs, but things that really were important and contributed. And I'll just read through the bullets. First, the EITC, the income tax credit, was substantially expanded in 1990 and again in 93. And then along with that, there's almost an 11% increase in the real minimum wage in the United States. So after accounting for inflation through the 90s, because the minimum wage level rose by about 11% through the 90s, those two things together should substantially increase the earning capacity of single mothers on welfare. And in fact, they did, and increased the number of women working in that category. So together, you know, depending on how many children you have and so how big the earned income tax credit is, just the earnings power of minimum wage women went up by maybe a third for most of those single parent families. Another thing in the background, the economy was just really strong from 1993 onward. Unemployment rates dropped late 90s, down below 5% unemployment rates, very low historical rates. That increased employment opportunities for poor people, too. And a few other things that I guess I won't spend much time on here, like Medicaid being detached from AFDC, so when you get a job, you can keep your medical benefits. All right, those are background things. Now we finally come to the question that was raised earlier. So what was welfare reform? What changed in these programs in the mid-90s? And I'll try to just walk through these bullets briefly. These are the main components of welfare reform. First, devolution, which is to say the system of voluntary waivers for which states could apply in the late 80s, early 90s, that was institutionalized. So after 1997, instead of a welfare policy in the United States, we've got 51 welfare policies. Every state in the District of Columbia has the responsibility to devise its own welfare program. All the federal eligibility requirements were lifted. Payment rules were abridged. The federal government did lay out some basic guidelines for programs, but within those guidelines, states have a lot of opportunity to set their own benefit levels, their own effective tax rates as people move out of poverty, the asset limits. You can let people own a car, a decent car, so they can get to work instead of saying, no, you've got to spend down so you're absolutely poor before you can qualify for this program. Many states have set up asset accounts, you know, so people could start saving money without becoming ineligible as they're working, save up to make a down payment on a house, those kinds of things. States can decide how the benefits come. They can come in cash. A state can say, no, we really want to allocate a lot more to child care so that we know that's a worry and we want to provide that kind of support. They can allocate it to other social services for family, you know, marriage counseling, however they want to allocate the funds. States can divert people from AFDC. Before, it was an entitlement. You just qualify, you get it. Now if a person comes in and says, you know, I can't make my rent this month. My child was sick, had to pay the emergency room. State can say, we got a special program for that. You don't have to go on welfare and have the clock start ticking against your federal eligibility for welfare. We got a rent support program here. Let's get you into that for a couple months. And is there anything else we can do for you? So much more diversity in the way state can offer programs. If you're wondering, in most cases, the benefit that continued to go to non-working traditional welfare families really did not change much across states in this period. And we'll get to why that was possible in a minute. But you might think, well, was money just diverted from people who are really hardcore poor and sent into other social services for relatively employable folks? And it appears there's not much evidence for that. So there's first, devolution. It's a grand experiment now. Second, funding. AFDC was a federal matching grant program. States decided what benefit they would pay. The federal government roughly matched that with about as much money. After 1997, the states received block grants based on the size of welfare spending in the early 90s. So instead of the federal government saying, whatever you decide to give, we'll match it, now states just receive a block. The block's fixed for at least the next 5 years, and it's turning into six because the Senate didn't get around to thinking about this year. So states have an incentive. They just get a block of money. It's a little lower than the total AFDC program used to be. But now they've got an incentive. If they can reduce participation in the program, they've got more left per person involved in the program, being more generous with those in it, you know. So if they can be creative in helping people other ways, the benefit per person can rise. And as it turned out, as we'll see, participation in the program shrank by about 60%. So states now have much more money to spend if they wish. To avoid a race to the bottom under this system, you know, what if every state says, okay, we'll give you $5 a month. Oh, no, Nebraska, we'll give you $4 a month. All right, we'll give you $3. What if governors get in competition to save some budget by dumbing down benefits? The federal government, one guideline was, requiring that all states continue to spend at least 70% of their pre-Perwara budget on TANF spending. So it's kind of locked in and not possible to dumb down without losing major other support from the federal government. Work requirements. States are free to set work requirements, like requiring work of people who receive benefits. In fact, to continue to receive their full block grant in the first 5 years of TANF, states must reduce participation in the programs by 50%. So half of their 1996 caseload has to be moved either into work or into direct work preparation programs or just completely off assistance and independence. As it turned out, that was not a hard target to hit. The caseloads kind of shrank on their own more than that. But states are free to set work requirements and encouraged to set it by the new rule. Time limits. T stands for temporary in TANF, temporary assistance. And there's just a sea change in the attitude toward income support in this program. At the federal level, a family may only receive federal benefits for 60 months for that head of household's lifetime. So once you're receiving benefits, the clock's ticking, and you've got 5 years in your whole lifetime. States are free to set shorter limits on support, and about half the states did. States are also free to say, look, if you do everything we've asked you to do, and you're just in difficulty, we're not going to cut off your benefits. We're going to fund it out of our state revenues. You won't get any federal money, but we're going to continue to support you. 8 states did that, including my state, Michigan, if I may say so. I probably shouldn't take the time, but a former student of mine, turns out, was one of the two state legislators, I'm a little nervous talking about it, who crafted most of the welfare reform legislation. A Republican from a suburban congressional district who kind of did the right thing and champions Habitat for Humanity. And more largely for that reason, Michigan says, do what we've asked and no limit to support the rest of your life if necessary. And you should know that even at the federal level, at 5-year limit, every state can have as many as 20% of its 1996 caseload exempted from that limit. So there is a provision for sort of a hardcore long-term difficulty, you know, substance abuse cases, that kind of thing. But states have kind of a built-in waiver for that group, under the feeling that roughly out of our waiver experience, it looked like about 80% of the population was kind of employable, and maybe 20% had really serious, substantial problems that would take more than 5 years to work on. So there are these time limits to TANF. States can set limits on spells, by the way, too. So you can say you've got a 5-year limit, but only, say, 18 months in every spell. If you've been on 18 months, it's just time to... We're setting a threshold to give you some encouragement to get going on finding work and moving on. Family structure. A lot of the verbosity of the law was aimed at family structure, that is, trying to hold families together and to prevent breakup and to not encourage births out of wedlock, that sort of thing. I realize it's a difficult topic because it's just one of those built-in tensions in public policy. You know, you might like to encourage stable families, and it appears there's a lot of research that in the well-functioning, stable two-parent families, the outcomes for children tend to be better than other arrangements. On the other hand, you don't want to lock people into abusive situations, so it's just a very difficult topic. Maybe for that reason, the law had a lot of talk about decline, you know, changes in family structure the last 30 years, ways the law might be rewritten, but really not much of substance in the law to affect this. States were allowed to introduce family caps, which is to say a state can say if a family is receiving support and then another child is born, we won't increase support to that family, a family cap. Some sorts of people are kind of excited about that. It looks like in the eating the pudding that those caps just don't matter much to family structure. On average, it's about a $60 a month benefit having another child. who decides, oh, gee, I think I'll have another child. I could get $60 a month. You know, the diapers are $40. It doesn't make any sense. So the family cap, it's in the law. It's an option for states. It doesn't look like empirically there's much effect. Teenage mothers were expected to continue in school if they'd not finished high school and to live in a supervised environment. So fortunately, that's usually not a requirement to live with parents because it looks like maybe a fourth of these cases are incest cases. You wouldn't want to limit the person to continue in the family, but some kind of you can't move out on your own, in other words, in some states and continue to receive benefits. Place of birth. Illegal immigrants arriving after August of 1996 are, in general, ineligible for any federal support in TANF or food stamps or supplemental security income, disability income, any of that, roughly for 9 years. We could talk a long time about that, about the ethics of doing that and the reasons for doing it. Essentially, a lot of pressure from a few states that do have very high immigration rates and whose their perception was that their state budgets were just hemorrhaging out of this phenomenon. And so that became law. And then finally, charitable choice. And remind me, Ed, is it quarter after five we're aiming for, isn't it? Okay. Charitable choice is a provision of the PRWRA, the Welfare Reform Act. You know, many states over the years have contracted for services with community organizations and faith-based organizations. So in providing things like marriage counseling and job placement services and substance abuse programs, all that sort of stuff that goes with welfare spending, often it's not the state directly providing the service. It's contracted out to a community organization or a nonprofit organization. Charitable choice legislation tries to remove federal discrimination against granting those contracts to so-called faith-based organizations, organizations that explicitly have some faith-based character to their program. So let's say an inner-city church program that aims at substance abuse cases, you know, and in its work it just says to people, you know, we think part of the basic problem here is your relationship with God. It's a matter of self-esteem, relationship with others, many things. We think it's ultimately grounded in something deeper. The attempt in charitable choice was to remove discrimination against such programs, and it's a complicated piece of legislation. And I think for those of you who may be going to the graduate Christian Fellowship tomorrow night, I'll probably just take this little chunk of the talk and expand it and talk about charitable choice legislation tomorrow. So there's the hook to come back for the next talk. But essentially, it tries to maintain the religious liberty of these organizations by creating an even hand in hiring policies. So those organizations may limit their employment to people who share their faith-based perspective on substance abuse counseling, marriage counseling, whatever. So the people who receive the contracts are not liable to the same federal civil rights legislation to hire employees without regard to, say, religion. You know, they're free to hire people who share their faith-based perspective. On the other hand, to preserve the liberties of people receiving the service, everybody must be provided with a secular alternative. Anybody who objects to a faith-based provider, there's always got to be a secular alternative there. The faith-based providers are audited on the same basis as other secular providers. On the other hand, to maintain the separation of church and state, all the federal support goes into a separate fund. Only that fund is audited, so the federal government can come in and audit your what you're paying your priests and your nuns and other things like that. But the faith-based providers are subject to the same evaluation that any provider would be. So if you're running a program that's not doing much, you just don't get funded, you know. The money cannot be used for any overtly religious purpose. So if you receive money for a drug counseling program, you can't fund worship services with it. People receiving the service can't be required to participate in any overtly religious thing. So if you come to talk about your marriage, you can't be forced to stay for the evangelistic presentation at 7. You know, so that's charitable choice legislation. It turns out that religious organizations, and particularly those in the Reformed theological tradition, had a big role in developing that legislation. And so I think tomorrow night I'll just talk about that charitable choice process. Let's talk about evaluating this whole movement, those seven things that together constitute welfare reform. Here I've got just five more bullets to work through. First, caseloads. And I already gave away the story here. Since the mid-90s, about a 60% reduction in the number of people receiving income assistance. It's stunning, you know. Caseloads back down to where they were in the 60s. That in itself, though, tells us nothing. I mean, anybody can reduce caseloads by just saying, you're not eligible, you know. Not much of an accomplishment. So really, you ought to be at least more concerned, really, about the experience of these people in employment. And beyond that, their experience in earnings. So by folks moving out of eligibility or out of participation in the programs, did they find work? And in that work, did their incomes rise? So did this set of reforms do much about poverty? So first, employment. Really pretty dramatic changes in what we call labor force participation rates among the traditional welfare population. I think I mentioned earlier in the 60s, people participating in these programs, about 15% were working. By the early 90s, that was down to around 6%. By 1999, it was up almost to 30%. So really dramatic, historically unprecedented levels of labor force participation, getting connected with the job market. But you hope then that even if it didn't change incomes, even if poverty remained unchanged, I'd rather be participating in a program where wages grow over time than in a federal program where support declines over time. So you'd hope, at least in the long run, even if no immediate change in income, that's a hopeful sign. But really, the kind of rubber hits the road issue, what's the effect on poverty, on incomes of families? And here, unfortunately, I got to do the economist thing and punt a little bit. We don't have very good measures for what we really would like to observe, because you'd like to have a comprehensive measure of the well-being of families. Not just did their income rise, but how about access to health care and crime in their neighborhood and stability of family structure and vulnerability and recessions and all those things. You'd like to know, is there a comprehensive, quantum improvement in their status and culture? Are their social relationships, they have more accessibility, more upward mobility? And that the measures are pretty hazy of a lot of those things, but let's take a couple of tries at it. First, the most obvious way, just look at poverty rates. So just measured officially reported income, what's happened to poverty rates since the waivers began, early 90s, and especially through welfare reform. And that's generally pretty good news. I don't think there's room to just gloat, but it's generally good news. I'd said poverty rates just hung around the low teens for 30 years there. And by 1999, they're down to around 8.5%. Poverty rates just hadn't moved in prosperity or anything. And then to drop off like that, that's hopeful. If you divide it up by demographic groups, like African-American poverty rates, just for 30 years, they've been hanging there in the low 30s, low to mid-30s. Maybe go up to 35% in a recession, come down to 32% in prosperity. And then you hit 1995 or so, and by 1999, African-American poverty rates down to low 20s. And if you chop it any other way, Hispanic groups, other kind of demographic groups, almost any way you chop it, there's about a 30% reduction in poverty rates in about 5 years. And given our long-term history, that is encouraging. It's not all good news, because by most accounts, officially measured income, deep poverty, incomes below half the poverty level. It looks like there's some evidence that as measured by officially reported income, poverty got a bit worse. Or maybe you've heard of poverty gap measures, like the distance of the typical poor family from the poverty line. And that poverty gap it probably grew by maybe $60 or so during this period. So from around $1,450 down to around $1,510, something like that. So not a huge change, but that's reason for concern that if the poorest are ending up more poor. On the other hand now, see if this statistics kind of works for you. You might think if you have a poverty revolution that's kind of working, the first people to benefit will be the people who kind of had the most positive prospects. So it sort of makes sense. As people move out of poverty, the folks left in poverty will be harder cases. And so you might expect the average person remaining in poverty is a little worse off. So you could almost say that the poverty gap only grew by about $60 is really pretty good news, because you move so many people out of poverty who were the easiest to move out. If the average person left in poverty isn't much worse than before, people left in poverty before, their poverty gap was bigger. So another way to examine this, if you need one more way, really, official poverty, official income measures are not quite what we're after, because we do know that to the extent we can observe it, families in poverty have multiple income sources, and not all those are official or reported. and we can get some rough, by its nature it's hard to observe, but if you say compare the social surveys that we have of a person's income, and then you cross-index and go to those people employer records and get their official reported income, and then you cross-reference to other surveys in which you've actually got measures of their consumption spending, their ability to support themselves. You can kind of triangulate, and it looks like in this bottom quintile of the population, we've got underreporting of income on the order of like at least 50%, sometimes as high as 100%. So just using the official poverty numbers, you've got some slack in those measures. If you instead try to use surveys that measure actual purchasing power, consumption spending of families, then it looks like in the late 90s, even people in deep poverty, their consumption spending rises. People in deepest poverty, not a lot. But the general story is it looks like everybody improved. People in deepest poverty, maybe barely, and maybe some of those very deep in poverty were worse off in the late 90s. In general, it's a good story. I don't want to be seen to be communicating that things are just great and all our problems are over, because it's just obviously not true. You move a number of people out of poverty, well, fine. Now their family, instead of earning $15,000, they're earning $15,500, so they're above the threshold, but there's still a tremendous amount of need and opportunity for caring for each other. But, I think it's good to celebrate successes when they happen so we don't get discouraged. And, in general, it's not a bad story. Effects on family structure, charitable choice. I did mention briefly before, family structure means some very muted hopeful signs, if you like the idea of more stable families, but they're really very muted. It doesn't look like these kinds of changes, at least immediately, seem to touch disintegration of families. It seems to be driven by other things. Low wages of males in this category, high incarceration rates. These are things kind of beyond these policies that tend to disturb family structure. And then charitable choice, the effect of these changes in contracting at the state level. I think you'd have to say the jury is out. If you're looking for what you read sometime, the story that, we opened the floodgates of charity and removed discrimination and things are just great, it's premature, I think, to say anything like that. The federal law changes really only apply to a fairly narrow number of programs. It turns out in our federal system, the changes don't take effect until states mandate that their procurement practices change, and states have been very slow to do that. President Bush set up a White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives to try to compel states to get their laws in line with the federal law and try to expand this into other programs, and that really has not gone very well. So, charitable choice jury is out. Let's stop it there, and if there's anything you'd like to talk about, then I'd like to... I think we have some time to just chat, don't we? Yeah.
How does the institutionalization of surplus food fit into these screens like food banks?
Now, I bet you know a lot more about this than I do. Give me a question. That would be one of the... food banks, emergency food assistance, that would be included in the idea of charitable choice. You can say that in the late 90s that apparently, food emergency claims seemed to fall in the late 90s, which is another kind of good sign that, you might fear if you set time limits and work requirements, people get pushed out into more desperate situations. And food is one of those areas where it doesn't appear that happened much. What would make you hesitate on that is that we're really just getting information now about the effect of this recession that began about a year ago. And so we don't, at least the official, academic economist world is just now starting to think about what, when we have a downturn, how vulnerable have we made people by these changes in law.
In terms of things like a greater society,
into work, the average wage people got was sort of upper $7. And that with the AFD, with the EITC supplement, you know, so it's kind of, it's above what you think of as the minimum wage. But you're right that there are, that's an average, and there's a lot of variety around the average. I decided in the interest of time I would just lop off anything about where to go from here. But I'm guessing you and I would have a lot in common about what we think of as the next step. We've got sort of muted positive experience here, and let's celebrate that. But the next, if there's to be another round of welfare reform, it would have to be much more, I want to say more substantial. These were substantial changes. But I think just basic restructuring to the way we live together are going to be the next round that will matter. Now, one of these is the structural wages in the United States. I think one of them is just the way we live together, urban planning, urban, the structure of cities. We have just whole areas that are so enclaved off from poverty or from prosperity, jobs mislocated in places where people can't get to them, transportation systems that don't work, child support, child care that's not available, food stamp offices that are only open during working hours when you're working. So a lot of just fundamental restructuring can need to happen. Now, you know, the manufacturer doesn't receive this subsidy. It's income support that you only can access if you're working. But the supplements... thinking that the earned income tax credit will somehow hold down wages for people beyond where they would otherwise be.
Yeah, like sometimes I've followed some of the statements saying people who are for things that their earned income tax credit are very much against raising the minimum wages and not even having one to begin with. So.
I think that's a separate question, though, about where the subsidy falls and whether it holds down expenses for employers. I mean, our experience in the 90s was just labor shortages. I think the EITC was irrelevant to where wages ended up, late 90s. Minimum wage was, for very many people, irrelevant. I mean, people coming off AFTC getting 7.5, 8, 8.50 offers when the minimum wage is 5.15. I guess I'm having trouble conceiving of that. I'll have to think about this by tomorrow night. Conceiving of how this becomes a subsidy to the employer that would affect prices they charge across the border.
Putting the pressure on them to do that.
Yeah.
It is a whole, like when you talk about like Mark,
United States is not a Marxist country. I mean, it's hard to just generate value created by workers that would cover higher wages. I mean, in general, you think over the long haul, by experience, productivity can rise, people contribute more. I'm sorry? Well, I'm sorry, that's what I thought, that's how I thought the question was phrased. Maybe I misunderstood. I mean, in general, we don't set wages based on the need of the person applying. I mean, I don't get higher wage because I have more children than people without children at my place of work. It. Was it a better world without the EITC then? I mean, wouldn't the end of that logic be we ought to remove all income support programs, make people really desperate?
They're contributing to lack of community, right? They're
went through McLean's looking for something, and The Economist, I just couldn't find any current, anything current on this. It would surprise me if British Columbia isn't taking the lessons from their own self-sufficiency project 8 years ago. I don't know if you talk to the median politician or the median voter, what you'd hear. I do have a little bit about that, actually. I've got some talk about this. Public opinion surveys from the mid-90s. So let me try a two-part answer. First would be, how did people justify this in the 80s, 90s, and the other would be in principle. Are there other ways you might think about work expectations that would not be, punitive? How did I turn this out? There we go. These are just a couple national opinion survey results. So 1994, people asked, would you favor or oppose replacing the current system with a completely new system? It's going to get poor people off welfare if that system costs government more money in the next few years, and the vast majority, yes. It doesn't appear to be a concern for just saving tax. It's always proposed that way. We'll cut your taxes, and it doesn't look like that's the average American's concern. They're willing to pay more for an effective program. Do you favor or oppose limiting how long you can receive welfare? A vast majority favor that. These don't tell you, though, who is answering questions that way. Here's some breakouts by demographic group. Do you think the welfare system does more good than harm because it provides assistance and training? Or does it do more harm than good because it encourages family breakup, discourages work ethic? And here you got, like, welfare participants, 2-1, saying it's a bad system. People participating in it, it's ruining our work ethic. You come down to these questions. What proposals would be effective? Requiring work, welfare recipients, 75% of them saying yes. That would be a good thing. So there's one answer. If it's based on the idea that people are just lazy, then the people receiving the benefits think so too, which is kind of a stretch for me to believe that. I just think there are other ways to, frankly, less cynical ways to think about this. I think we're created workers. Work is a good thing. Work's before the fall, not after. It's not imposed as a result of sin. God's a worker. We're naturally fulfilled by working. So, I'm sorry, I want to interrupt you.
Oh, no, I work's great, but we are improving. The
right. Which?
Which is assuming that people don't want to.
Let me try coming at this last several conversations a little, see if this is a way of coming at it. What are our goals in this whole enterprise of caring for each other in these ways? I think they're really complicated. For example, we'd like to give people a second chance. We don't want to just say an unwise choice, that's it, you're marked. On the other hand, we don't want to subsidize the effects of bad choices. We want to help adults be responsible. Just be adults. But we don't want to penalize children for bad decisions of adults, you know. We want to encourage stable family life. We don't want to kind of get people stuck in abusive situations because if they step out, then they're in poverty and they get stinking benefits, you know. So I think anywhere you look in these kinds of policies, you've got these dilemmas which are built on just what it is to be human. To be human is to be in paradox, you know. The line between good and evil doesn't run between me and somebody else. It runs through me and through you and through welfare policy and everywhere else. So we're always just kind of cobbling together, trying to construct something. You know, same thing with you want to maintain incentives to work. You want to make work pay. But you don't want to somehow erode social responsibility of the institutions of civil society. It's just a dilemma. The more you do of one, the more you tend to impose on the other. So I think we're always just groping, you know, trying to say what kind of mix of policies is going to somehow kind of maximize the good human potential in the creation and somehow best restrain the effects of the fall. And in that kind of world, that complex a set of dilemmas, it's hard for me to be dogmatic, to be partisan about this. You know, I think we're all just kind of groping our way through and we try something and golly, that seemed to help, but we're never going to construct a system that will simultaneously satisfy all the requirements of justice. You know, you can be dogmatic if you take all those dilemmas and you just choose one side to endorse and ignore the others. You know, and I just don't think that's an honest view of what it is to be a human. So.